Title of this morning's message is Custom Made Headphones. If you have not noticed, Christians are always talking. The Christians that we have determined will make the most suitable leaders. The men and women we believe will give us the best shot at explaining the paradox of the gospel. The ones with golden tongues get ordained and are awarded with even more opportunities to talk. We've got radio shows, TV channels, stadium-sized revivals, our own genre of music, publishing houses, podcasts, seminaries, private schools, theme parks. We have cruise ships, clothing lines, websites, conferences. The church has built enough platforms to talk about God that a parallel industry specializing in the support of all this talking has sprouted to support the sound of our own voice. Each week I get a catalog in the mail from a distributor of sound and video equipment that claims to specialize in serving churches. The microphones, they say, are tailored to meet the specific needs of churches, as if the microphones endow the user with magic speaking powers. The loudspeakers, they say, are calibrated just for churches. They even try to pass off the plain old AAA batteries especially designed for churches. But the joke might be on us. Maybe we're the only ones that haven't noticed that our specialty might not be loving our God with all our heart, soul, and might, or releasing captives or recovering the sight of the blind. It is talking about loving the Lord with all of our heart, soul, mind, and talking about letting the oppressed go free, and talking about recovering the sight of the blind, not to the world, but to each other. We're artists communicating the gospel with our words, but there are times in life when all this talk will cost us more than a Sunday morning. Life will present moments when your talking gets you in trouble with the kings and queens, the principalities and powers, your family, your friends. So when you leave the safety of this sacred plane called Louisville Seminary, the voice you've assumed as a witness to the gospel of Jesus Christ will demand that you risk your pride, your comfort, and perhaps even your life. And I have scanned the catalog enough times to know they don't make a special microphone for moments like this. But maybe it's not a microphone that we need. What if what we've been missing all along is a pair of particular headphones tuned to catch the frequency reserved for the voice of God? When speaking up becomes a dangerous diversion from the life that we thought we would lead, a special microphone is not going to get us out of trouble. When God calls you by name to speak for those without a voice, an amplifier with more wattage will not do the job. For such a time as this, you will need help. Not to speak, but to hear. Hear, O Israel, that the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. to hear that you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your might. And to hear these words above all the other voices fighting for our attention, our devotion, our allegiance, to hear these words in their singular insistence that nothing else matters. And still, God knew that these words would be hard to hear, that they might demand a repetitive reminder because they are words that are hard to hear in a world where loving is synonymous with liking, a feeling that can come and go depending on your mood. They might demand a repetitive reminder because they're words that are hard to hear in a world where the freedom to move on to another passing pleasure when we get bored is encouraged. How are we to love one thing above all other things with all of our heart, soul, and might when we are subtly being pressured to be more efficient at work, at home, and at church in an effort to stretch out the boundaries of time to take advantage of all the lovely options that cheap travel, an online anything, and a virtual reunion with your senior class from high school that Facebook will gladly give you if you accept their friend requests. And so, the Shema, the imperative to hear, is an affront to the limitless possibilities of the present. To bind yourself to one thing means you might miss out on something. These days, that is hard to hear. And so we're told to hear again and again and again, to keep the acclamation of divine unity in our heart, to recite them to our children, to talk about the God who has bound us up into an alternative kingdom when we're at home and when we're away, to repeat our eternal sentence as prisoners of love when we lie down, and then when we get up, to tattoo our insistence that nothing else matters as a sign on our hand, and fix it as an emblem on our forehead. The one God of heaven and earth knows that we are hard of hearing, and that the other gods will make it convenient to turn in their direction, and that total, complete, unadulterated love will require a repetitive, simple reminder. And in this sophisticated, nuanced, complicated world, it may be its simplicity that makes the Shema so hard to hear, necessitating the persistent prodding of spiritual sticky notes, reminding us to put on some custom-made headphones to hear. From the end of the first century, the recitation of the Shema was integrated into the individual and the corporate spiritual practices of Judaism. One commentator notes that there is no more important devotional tradition than the reading of the Shema. That word, the Shema, derives from the first word of Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, an imperative to hear. Something similar to the words we find in the fourth verse of Deuteronomy 6 show up again in Deuteronomy 11 and in Genesis 49 and in Numbers 15 and in all three of the synoptic gospels. And in the tradition of the rabbis, the Shema came to identify the immutable unity of God that was preserved by God's sovereignty. It was not a reactionary affirmation made against the threats of Gnosticism or dualism or paganism. The unity of God as expressed by God's sovereignty did not demand a defense. It just was, irrespective of what other popular religious movements were in vogue at the time. And so it became a prelude to corporate worship, a short, repetitive reminder that preceded readings from the Torah when the faithful gathered in the local synagogue. It was uttered with enough frequency to not be a liturgical artifact, sensitive to interpretation from smart people in theological schools and from pastors like me. You don't hear it in the fourth chapter of Luke's gospel when Jesus stands to read from the scroll of Isaiah. It is the most stunning debut performance in the history of Nazareth's synagogue. You don't hear it there, but it's there. Joseph's son stands up to read and the people stare. And he sits back down and that's it. The show is over. It's the shortest sermon ever preached by Jesus, but the length does not matter. What he said was part of the story. The rest of it concerns how he said it. I wish I was there that day, but I wasn't. There must have been something in his step, you know, that walk from the platform. His stride, maybe. That must have been it. I imagine it was long with a little sway and an appropriately subtle lean. And if it wasn't in his stride, maybe it was in the way he held his head up, square, above his shoulders, balanced and completely in control. It wasn't his head or his stride, it had to be his arms. They swung at just the right angle and rhythm with his step, loose but not careless, confident without being showy. How long could the distance have been from the podium to the pew? 10 feet? 20 feet? Or did Jesus just sit in the back? I like to imagine that he sat way in the back, on the very last row. The scriptures set the eyes of all the people gathered in the synagogue on the Sabbath. They set their eyes on Jesus. They were stuck there after he finished his reading from the 61st chapter of Isaiah. Isn't the story a little bit better if he sits in the back? And with a little something in his step, he has to saunter all the way down the aisle to the pews in the rear. The story is better if the crowd has to turn their head and strain their necks to hold their stare, amazed at what just happened. So let's just go ahead and do it. Let's put Jesus in the back with a little something in his step and a head that's balanced right up on his shoulders. Two arms swinging with just enough swagger. And the long walk from the podium to the last pew gave him plenty of time to compose a good sermon. What would he say? We don't know much about the origins of the synagogue, but at some point in Jewish history, the synagogue became the local spot for pious Jews to gather for prayer and worship. And like the worship practices of churches in the liturgical tradition, services in the synagogue followed a predictable pattern. Worship began with a recitation of the Shema from Deuteronomy chapter 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. They'd affirm this together as a community, out loud. They knew the words by heart. After the Shema, there'd be prescribed readings from the Torah. Next, they'd say a prayer while facing Jerusalem. And after the prayer, any male could come forward and offer a reading and then a sermon. Usually, the volunteers would express their desire to preach and tell the synagogue attendant which prophet they'd be reading from before the service began. We've already been told by the gospel writer of Luke in the introduction that Jesus had been preaching at other synagogues in Galilee, and his messages were received with praise. His reputation as a skilled communicator was spreading. But today is different. Today he is in his hometown. We don't get to hear what he said at the other synagogues, but the gospels, they're not intended to be these full historical accounts. The gospel writer of Luke left out the transcript of the other sermons because he wants us to hear this one. The shortest sermon ever preached. This one. In his hometown. Where everyone knows his father. This is the one that matters. And the crowd gathered in the synagogue that day got lucky because it was the shortest sermon they'd ever heard. But it's possible that he might not have needed to say anything. They were already staring at him, mesmerized at the mysterious presence of Joseph's son. They were already caught up in his reading. They were already captivated by his selection of scripture. They were sent into a silent stupor by his spirit-filled stride. They were rendered speechless by the manner of his speaking. Funny thing is, the sermon probably couldn't have been shorter, and it's possible he could have skipped it altogether. The Shema was, and still is, the Jewish confession of faith par excellence. It was the fundamental doctrine of Judaism. By reciting it upon waking and sleeping, it was the beginning and the end to each day. It determined how we relate to time. By reciting it to our children and talking about them at home, the words determined how we relate to our families. By carving these words into our doorposts and gates, this ethic of singular love was the beginning and the end to how we relate to our property. By marking them on our hands and fixing them as an emblem on our forehead, the singularity of our devotion to God was the beginning and the end to how we relate to our bodies. You'd think God covered it all by encouraging us to hear that there is one God, one love to commit all our heart, all our soul, and all our might to fulfilling. But ever since then, we have been talking. Our sermons are long. Our theology is nuanced and it's sophisticated. Our churchy grammar is enamored with long sentences littered with a bunch of cautious commas stacked between just-in-case commentary and parenthetical pauses that seem to interrupt more than encourage movements of the Spirit. These days, Christians are talking more and hearing less. So I dare to ask if the perpetual sound of our own voice, presented as a defense against the apparent sin of biblical reductionism, has left us unable to decipher the signal from the noise. Maybe our antidote is a pair of those custom-made headphones so we can hear the hum of love that doesn't discriminate, and the hiss of love that doesn't depend on our feelings, and the hush of love that is imperceptible when our love is turned too far inward. Midway through the second century, Rabbi Akiba was executed as a revolutionary by the Romans. His death was not unlike other martyrs of that period, except for the fact that as he died, he recited the Shema. He said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord." And then he prolonged his pronunciation of that final word, alone, letting it be. Like he was wearing a pair of custom-made headphones, singing along with the voice of God, his life and the kingdom of God unified eternally. When we stop talking, what will others hear?